You're listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Todd Hatton.
And I'm Chad Lampe. This past week, a large amount of news has been circling around alleged financial problems for a group of businesses that employ, at last public count to the Murray Ledger and Times, nearly 300 people. The most recent news comes in the form of an email to employees of C.A. Jones Management Group from owner and CEO Chuck Jones, announcing his departure from that role for many companies. Shelley Baskin has been covering the story for WKMS and joins me to talk about this complicated story. Thanks, Shelley.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, tell me a bit about the makeup of C.A. Jones Management.
Well, C.A. Jones Management is an umbrella company that manages several businesses in the local area. And the ones involved in this instance are going to be pretty recognizable to folks around here. And that's BlackRock Investments, Southeastern Book Company, College Book Renter, Integrated Computer Solutions, and a retail store, Book and Bean. And C.A. Jones Management Group oversees the operations of those various companies.
So these are the companies that Mr. Jones will no longer manage?
That's right. While Jones will maintain his ownership interest in the companies, he will no longer lead them. This stems from a suit filed by his business partner, David Griffin, in March. Griffin alleged that Jones was mismanaging company funds. He says in his complaint that he filed in court that Jones was using the funds to buy a house, a boat, and in some cases for giving large donations to several local charities.
That case, though, was dismissed.
Yeah, the case was dismissed as part of a settlement that they reached where a consultant was appointed to run the businesses while Jones just maintained ownership.
What do we know about the consultant that's now going to be running these businesses?
The consultant that's running these businesses is Miles McDonald. He's with Kraft CPA in Nashville. Kraft was the original company requested by Griffin in his complaint to appoint a receiver for the companies in order for him to get his investment back and have the companies run. Miles is not a receiver. He's just a consultant. A receiver would have had to been appointed by the court, but instead Griffin and Jones reached a settlement on that.
We've also learned this week of two other lawsuits that are pending against Griffin and Jones, alleging they failed to pay back debt to a bank and to a vendor. What do we know about that?
Well, the first complaint was filed by Planters Bank in Hopkinsville, and it alleges that Jones's companies failed to pay back loans to the amount of about $11 million that were made by the bank over the course of a few years. The other complaint is from a book and supplies vendor for College Book Renter, who alleges that about $19 million has been failed to be repaid by Jones's companies.
So we're talking about $30 million allegedly outstanding between the bank loan and the supplier and product vendor for College Book Renter.
That's right.
Now, this is big news for Murray because of the amount of employees that this may affect. And again, we've mentioned at last count from the Murray Ledger and Times in 2011 that C.A. Jones Management employs nearly 300 people. And also, there's a significant amount of prominence for Jones and his family in the community.
That's right. He was named Murray Callaway County Chamber of Commerce Citizen of the Year last year. Part of that stemmed from making one of the largest donations in Murray Callaway County United Way history. He was also in charge of C.A. Jones Management when it was Large Business of the Year a couple years ago for the Chamber of Commerce.
And you reached out to the consultant, Mr. McDonald. Were you able to find out what is ahead for the future of these companies?
I was able to speak to McDonald. He didn't have a comment at the time, and he was also not able to really give a timeline for when he would be able to talk about the future of the businesses in the area.
Well, Shelley Baskin, WKMS news reporter who's been following these events surrounding C.A. Jones Management Group in Murray, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A lack of patience is bringing changes to the Henry County Medical Center's hospital-run nursing home, the Henry County Healthcare Center. The facility has capacity for 150 residents, but around 30 beds are consistently empty, and it's spent the past few weeks in restructuring mode. Hospital officials have shut down one hall and cut two full-time jobs. They also expect to limit the number of new hires in the coming years. Angela Hatton spoke with CEO Tom G about the move and how it reflects a shift of view as the hospital prepares for the future in geriatric care.
It's been a trend at the hospital nursing home that you've had trouble filling beds. What's been the reason behind the decline? Yeah, we've seen a steadily declining census in the nursing home over the last probably 2 years, actually, and we're attributing that to a real shift in the way people are approaching long-term care right now. The advent of a lot of assisted living homes have taken some of the healthier population out of the nursing homes, and a lot of home and community-based services are being developed at least in Tennessee, and that's resulted in less people going to long-term care facilities.
And with the healthy population wanting to do home care and assisted living, are you at the medical center looking at increasing maybe services that you might do that would match that?
I think you're seeing at the hospital, you're seeing some of the similar types of things, but mostly what we're doing is we have a home health agency, so we do a lot of care in the home through that, and we have outpatient services, so people are not going even to the hospital as much as they used to. So, you're just seeing kind of some fundamental shifts to keeping people more at home and out in the community as opposed to in the facilities. But the hospitals, we've seen, fairly healthy census here lately, and we're doing okay here at the hospital, but the long-term care facility has been a little bit problematic.
And another reason for that is that the over 65 population is low right now, right? What's the future of that?
What we're seeing in rural areas in particular is that population growth is very slow or even non-existent in some communities. Henry County in the last decade rose about 5% in its population, but what we have been observing in the over 65 is for the first couple of years now of since the last census, we've seen just very slow growth, and we're projecting from now until about 2015 to only see about a 1.5 to 2% growth in the over 65 population. But we see after 2015 to 2020 a big jump in the over 65 population of about 15 or 16%. So we're seeing that baby boomer group come in now, and I think later part of this decade we will see a much bigger demand for institutional services and healthcare services because of that aging population that's coming along.
So how is Henry County Medical Center then maybe thinking about how you're going to be doing geriatric care in the next decade?
We're trying to make sure that we have our nursing home is well positioned and ready to take that population on. We actually need a new nursing home, so I'm hoping in the next 4 to 5 years to be able to build a new nursing home here in Henry County, and that we'll try to design that for that coming population. Otherwise, we're continuing to make sure we have a good range of health services in our medical center to take care of the elderly population that's coming along.
What you say about wanting to do a facility that fits into the aging population that you're expecting reminds me of what I've heard in, for example, Hopkins County. The Veterans Nursing Facility there had plans to build an extension, and they were hoping to have, instead of the traditional nursing home, a more home-like feel with rooms that actually looked like rooms that you would find in a residence rather than what you would see in a traditional nursing home.
Sure, and that's what we're looking at trying to do as we think about a future nursing home. It will not look like what's seen typically in nursing homes, where you see big long halls with single rooms or even doubled up rooms. I think you'll see more apartment looking like settings, probably in pods where you have then common living space, living rooms and kitchens and things like that, where people can have feel like they're in a home setting as opposed to an institutional setting. Yeah, we're definitely looking at that type of thing.
Angela Hatton spoke with Henry County Medical Center CEO Tom Gee. The debate over unpasteurized or raw milk has been heating up in the recent months. Those who drink it tout its nutritional benefits, but government health officials warn that consuming raw milk is not worth the risk of contracting a dangerous foodborne illness. Kentucky Public Radio's Rick Hallett brings us more on the dispute.
One day a week in a church parking lot in Lexington, dairy farmer Gary Oakes hands out glass bottles of raw milk from the bed of his pickup. It's milk that goes directly from the cow to the bottle and then is quickly refrigerated. About 40 people will stop by to collect their orders. It's illegal to sell unpasteurized cow's milk in Kentucky and some 20 other states, but Oaks and his visitors operate in a gray area of the law. Customers purchase shares in Oaks' dairy cattle herd, so they're essentially drinking milk from a cow they own.
It's an agreed upon that this animal belongs to them, and so we don't have any right to sell them. We just keep them abreast of how the herd is doing.
Oaks customers talk about raw milk with an almost religious fervor. It's a lot more expensive than the store-bought product, but Mike Dixon calls it the tastiest milk you've ever had.
Like liquid ice cream.
Dixon is a Lexington paramedic who drinks about a half gallon of raw milk each week.
There's a definite difference, and I think you could only know that by tasting it.
But more importantly, says another customer, John Mark Hack, is raw milk's nutritional value, something he says is lost during pasteurization when the product is heated. Hack is a former director of the Governor's Office of Agricultural Policy.
There are enzymes that are well documented to be present in raw milk that are a big boost to our immune systems. There are probiotics, healthy bacteria that's present in raw milk that facilitates good digestion.
But Dr. Robert Toks says raw milk can also contain something else.
Bacteria that make us sick.
Toks is a foodborne illness investigator at the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He says those disease-causing germs like salmonella and E. coli are killed by the heating process.
Pasteurization may slightly reduce some of the vitamins, but we don't think it leads to an important change in the nutritional quality of the milk.
The CDC says from 1998 through 2009, more than 1,800 people were sickened by raw milk and raw milk products, resulting in some 200 hospitalizations and at least two deaths, with most of the outbreaks occurring in states that allow sales. But proponents say there's risk involved with consuming anything, and they want the government to leave them to their own dietary choices. The argument has resulted in an unlikely union that's been lobbying for looser restrictions on raw milk, the so-called granola crowd of health food enthusiasts, and conservatives who want less government regulation.
I call them food liberty issues.
Republican Kentucky State Senator John Schickel doesn't drink raw milk, but last session he sponsored a bill aimed at keeping the state out of herd share and other natural food programs.
There's been a great coalition of people who are interested in these issues. It's a lot more people than what I realized.
Schickel's bill cleared the state Senate but died in the House. He says he plans to bring it back next year. The sale of raw milk for human consumption is also illegal in Indiana, but lawmakers have directed a study of the issue. An 18-member panel has been conducting an online public hearing this summer and will recommend how the product should be tested, bottled, and sold if the law is changed.
Okay, we'll go through a couple more doors. We'll go on the other side of the barn and show you where we do the milking.
Alan Yeagerlener serves on the panel. He and his wife Mary own the Swiss Connection Dairy Farm and store in Clay City, Indiana. They sell raw milk, but it has to be labeled as pet food. He hopes lawmakers will find a way to at least allow on-the-farm sales for human consumption.
People can see what's going on and talk to you, and if there is a problem, you immediately have a network there you can start dealing with the problem.
Yeagerlener's advisory panel has until December 1st to make its recommendations. Then next year, the Indiana General Assembly will decide if raw milk sales should be legalized.
This might be susceptible to flying, and maybe we'll go on with all the work, and it may nothing happen, too. So,
for Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
After the break, we resume our monthly conversations with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn and learn more about the ongoing budget prioritization work groups at MSU. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
We're here with Murray State President Dr. Randy Dunn. We begin our series of conversations for this academic year. Thank you very much for being here.
We're back once again, Chad. Very exciting.
It is. It's an exciting year for Murray State as well. In a speech I've heard you give a couple of times now, you're kind of setting the stage for Murray State as a transitional year.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be kind of associated with you discussing a new business model for Murray State. I wondered if you could explain a bit more about what's changing?
Well, I have used that term transitional year to describe 2012-13 for this reason. As many listeners know, we had a pretty difficult budget year when we learned that we were going to lose a little over 6% of our state appropriations from the university. For us, that comes to well over $3 million. So we knew that that could not be sustained over time and that we would have to make adjustments within the budget to deal with that. We weren't going to be able to just keep, you know, slamming tuition, increasing it, and not looking at some sort of reprioritization or cost cutting, particularly in an environment where fixed costs always continue to increase. So what we did actually to make the present year's budget, fiscal year 13 for this 12-13 academic year, was to dip into savings to the tune of about $1.9 million to get through this year. But that is going to allow us then the time to take on some very careful study and work to determine how we can do some reallocation, get some increased efficiency in savings, maybe look for additional revenue generation from alternative sources, and do those types of things so that the university is better positioned as we head into fiscal year 14. Now, again, I've used that term business model of the university, which sometimes causes folks in academia to shrink or twitch a little bit. And it's not that I'm saying that the university is a business, but we do have to look at business practices and the protection of fiduciary duties we're charged with, things of that nature. So we'll undertake the work this year to rethink that model and get us well positioned as we head into next year.
And that's part of the budget work groups that you've put together.
That's right.
The board has approved the work to move this forward, where I believe there'll be different areas that you look at, alternative revenue and also cost cutting. So if you could just explain maybe a little bit in the weeds how these groups are going to work.
Well, we've put together 12 teams across the campus. Nine of those are aligned or affiliated with the academic collegiate unit. So each of the colleges operates or has its own budget review team. Then there are three additional teams that really are university-wide, cross-cutting across the entire institution to look at programs and services, the offerings that we have out there, not just for student services or programs, but also what we do to support the region, various outreach efforts, service units, things of that nature. So programs and services is one. We'll take a broad look at all of the things we do in our repertoire under that umbrella term. A second institution-wide budget team is organizational efficiencies, and we'll look at ways, again, across the entire campus to figure out if there are ways we can wring out some costs from structures, systems that are currently in place. Now, that's not to say that we have anything in mind here, but we want to take a broad look, again, at every possibility is for consolidating costs, potentially outsourcing some things. That's not to say that anything will happen in that regard, but we want to look at it, think about ways, again, we can do things in kind of a tighter, leaner fashion to get us really some savings generated that we then could reallocate to other purposes. That third university-wide team has to do with generating alternative revenue. So we're going to start looking at a wide variety of things that we could do to bring in additional revenue streams to the university. And there are all kinds of ideas that, you know, are floating around out there. And we're going to try to look at everything from soup to nuts, if you will, in figuring out what things that we do might appropriately be monetized to provide additional revenue support to the university. So programs and services, efficiencies, alternative revenue are the three teams that are kind of standing out there, not tied to a college unit, as well as the nine that will be led by the deans to look specifically in the academic areas.
Is there kind of a meter that you're looking at when you combine your efficiencies and the amount of possible alternative revenues that you would like to hit? Like, would it be combined savings and growth of a certain amount?
No, we haven't set out that kind of target, and some may take issue with that, and you know they're free to do that. But what we're charging the teams to do is to undertake this work without some arbitrary bar set. If it was the case, Chad, that we were just looking to get 3% or 5%, whatever, pick a number, it doesn't matter. Probably the easiest way to do that would simply be to say to each of the budgetary and administrative units of the university, the scores of them that we have, hundreds of them that we have, find 3% or find 5%, make the cuts, and when you turn in your budget sheets for next year, just make sure it's reflected. In my view, that's the lazy person's way of doing this work. It leads to these across-the-board types of cuts. And if you look at what businesses, corporations, nonprofits, other universities are doing, many, many of them across the country, if anybody reads a newspaper, reads a website, follows broadcast news, knows that this work is going on to really look at the whole range of things that are done, in this case, in the name of the university, to think through their value, what they add to our mission and goals, to think about whether the priorities that established what we do maybe many years ago still hold true today, and really go through that type of analysis to think about the new model. Some things we probably need to shed off. Some things we can tighten up. Some things maybe others can do for us. Some things we do, we need to be monetizing and getting some revenue for it. And it's a much more complex undertaking that involves many people, as these 12 budget teams will, than just saying, oh, get us 3% or get us 5%. We're going to go through this exercise. We're going to see where we stand and put a list of recommendations together for the board as they're thinking about 9 months from now about the next budget and see where we go from there. I will say this, though. The idea here is to find savings, revenue, reallocation that can be pulled in centrally. So everything that we come up with will be assigned to a central pool. It won't be the case that if, using an example of my academic college, the College of Education comes up with some amount of savings, that doesn't turn around and go back to the college. Everyone is clear in understanding that this is an effort where we're looking to centrally change the business model, and what we see in reprioritization comes in centrally. But the idea then is, as we go forward, we have the ability to fund new programs, to continue to pay for the level of services and benefits that people have come to expect. We can keep doing the outreach work. You know, eventually we could look at a salary increase, things of that nature. So there is a little give and take there. While we're not giving this hard and set target, everybody does understand that this is a common undertaking that we're doing to essentially increase revenue for the university going forward.
And you're asking members of the university community to sit on these budget teams.
Right.
They're going to make some tough decisions.
Those are going to be tough jobs for those individuals. Yes. I didn't mean to cut you off,
yeah.
Chad, but I really do applaud the people who have been willing to step forward and represent one of our constituencies on campus, or indicated that they may have an expertise and are willing to sit on these panels, these teams, because as this work gets going through the course of the semester, it's going to be pretty high stakes. It's going to be high profile, and there will be people taking shots at these teams and the team members. And I really just want to applaud and thank the people who've stepped up and said they're willing to do it.
Is there anything that you're going to be able to do to try to either provide, I guess, provide cover for these people for well, the decisions they have to make?
Well, one of the things that is the case as we enter into this, these teams are board endorsed. They're not necessarily board approved. That is to say, I proposed the program, this approach to the board. They endorsed it and said, you know, President, yes, you may move forward. But the teams are appointed by me. They are not board committees per se. So they do have the ability to operate outside of the typical Public Meeting Act requirements that you would have, publishing of agendas. It's not to say that this work gets done in secret. When you have as many people serving on these teams as we have, that's not going to be the case. But there is a need for those groups to sit, ask some hard questions, look at data, take testimony, and craft recommendations, sitting as a group of experts a little bit removed from the public eye, if you will, while some of that key work is going on. And so there will be the benefit that they're not going to be in the press every week or having necessarily coverage of every meeting and the reports written up and published in newspapers or provided to, you know, WKMS or other places. I think there's a need to find that right balance between being transparent about what's going on, sharing the work that's taking place, but not having every one of these decisions, taking place under the scrutiny of the thousands who are going to be following what's going on.
And thanks for discussing more about this transition and the transitional period for this year and the budget prioritization mm-hmm. teams. Now let's talk just very briefly about the big picture at Murray State with some bricks and mortar projects. We had talked a few months back about the possibility of maybe saving Ordway Hall because of a grant that you found. I'd like to know more about that, and then how site preparation work is going on in Paducah.
Well, those are two projects that are sitting out there. We have others that I'm glad to mention, but Ordway Hall is slated for demolition. We haven't set a date because we're still working to find suitable and acceptable space for those remaining units that were housed in Ordway. And once that happens, Ordway can move forward for raising. What we had said when the board gave that authority back some number of months ago was that we wanted to hold off for about 6 months, and they'd set the date of June 1, 2012, before moving forward with the raising to take one last pass to secure any donors who might be interested in providing funds for a complete renovation, which was going to run about $10 million, and to see if we could find any grants to save the building. We had no donors come forward. Nothing came from that in an amount that was going to be even in the ballpark to do the renovation for Ordway. We did make a run at one historic preservation grant we found out of a California foundation. Went through a very thorough application process with that. And ultimately, they chose not to fund us. And that was really the only avenue we had for foundation support. So with that, really the last avenues were kind of closed. And at what point we can figure out office space for student affairs and get that last number of people relocated, then we'll start drawing up the plans, soliciting bids, and moving forward with Ordway's raising. There will be, of course, some sort of memorial program. A building memorial will be constructed at the site that's appropriate given its important role on the campus. Probably some type of memento program for people who want to be involved in that. As far as Paducah, we're making good progress there. Actually, we have site work that's underway, dirt being moved. I think we were budgeting somewhere in the $700,000 range for site preparation, earthwork, and things of that nature. And actually, the bids came in lower. So now we're moving, of course, into the next phase of work there with final design, getting all that approved as we look then to start construction. Everything at this point still looks good for a mid-fall opening about a year from now so that potentially we could be in the building and using it by the spring semester of 2014. I will mention one other, though, facility project if I could. Good progress continues to be made on the basketball practice facility that we've attached to the north side of the CFSB Center. And it's just going to provide a great opportunity for practice space, men's and women's basketball offices, as well as a Hall of Champion for athletics. And then we're completing and dedicating at homecoming some shell space, a large amount of shell space in what was the previously named Regional Business and Innovation Center next to the CFSB Center on Kentucky 121 north of the campus. We're completing all of that shell space. That building has been renamed by the board Heritage Hall, and in addition to the business incubator offices that are housed there, we'll also house very soon the Office of Regional Outreach as well as the Office of Development for the university. And located within that is going to be a Hall of Benefactors that is just going to be beautiful space for the entire university community. So even though we've really had no state support or money to carry on with large-scale projects through, again, I think a variety of creative approaches, donors, the cooperative agreement with the governments in Paducah, we are able to move forward on getting a number of construction projects going even without the state support.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. This week, Maid and Ellie Cinema features the critically acclaimed Beasts of the Southern Wild. Maid and Ellie's Larry Thomas and I take a look at the story of a girl named Hush Puppy, her family, her home, and the storm that threatens them all. Beasts of the Southern Wild seems like a very unusual movie. A lot of fantastical elements. What is this film about?
Well, you know, it's funny. We're sitting here talking about this film on the anniversary of Katrina. And this may very well be just an allegory of that in the first place, because you've got this family living in this wilderness community full of poverty, and they have to struggle to survive, and they make houses and whatever out of whatever they can find. And in the film, they have a boat that was made from like a truck bed and something else, because they hear a big storm is coming. And they want to be able to float. So you've got all these allegories going on about, you know, everything being devastated by a big storm, or living in what looks like already, you know, post-apocalyptic conditions, or whatever. And the interesting thing about this film is that the actors had never acted before. The director and the writer went out and personally cast them, and it's kind of like, holy cow.
it does seem from the reviews I've read so far that they really struck pay dirt with these actors.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This little girl, this Quevenjani Wallace, she was 5 years old when they cast the film. She was seven when they finished it, and she'd never acted before.
Really?
Yeah. She plays a character named Hush Puppy, by the way, which is another reference to the Southern Wild.
Oh, certainly. There don't appear to be any other name actors in here at all.
There are none. In fact, the guy who plays her father, I read somewhere that he runs a bakery, and they had to go interview him in the middle of the night because he spent his time in the kitchen making food overnight so that he'd have it for the store in the morning. He went ahead and did it, but I don't know if he's going to do any more, but I thought that was just, you know, fascinating that you go to such extremes to make a movie the way you want to make it.
I wonder how this contrasts with a film like, for instance, anything starring a Kate Winslet or a Helen Mirren. I mean, where you know that's who it is, and then you have a film like this where you don't have that name that distracts you from character and story.
Absolutely, you have no preconceived notions of what these people have done before, what they may do next, and it's great because you can just kind of go with the flow, so to speak.
I know that the star of the film is obviously a child, but is this the kind of film that children can come to?
Might be a little harsh for them. I mean, there's some disturbing stuff in it. I wouldn't take a real young child to see it.
I see.
It is a PG-13, but definitely of more important appeal to people who really appreciate films that are made independently, that are imaginative, and just in no way like anything else you've ever seen before.
Why don't we see more films like this?
Well, it's because sometimes if you get the money to do a film like this, you can't get good distribution for it. So nobody ends up seeing it. But this one seemed to just get everything right. These people got the movie made. Fox Searchlight picked it up, and it's been getting good playoff across the country. It's one of the more original films you'll be seeing probably between now and the end of the year.
In a million years, when kids go to school, they're going to know. Once there was a hush puppy, and she lived with her daddy in the bathtub.
You can find showtimes at our website, wkms.org. The musical Big River is playing at Murray's Playhouse in the Park through September 16th. Based on Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, the show follows Huck Finn after he leaves his home in Missouri and takes to the Mississippi River on a flatboat with a new companion, an escaped slave named Jim. Rose Kristen Presson sat down with director Lisa Cope and Michael Martin, who plays Jim, to talk about the show's themes of race, freedom, and morals.
How has this character of Jim been different from the ones you've played in the past?
It's the first role that I've played that's been race-specific, which has been interesting and kind of a pleasure of mine because I've always wanted to play something that meant something to my race, such as Jim. And so it's kind of fun and empowering. And
race is a big theme in this play. How have each of you approached it?
We've had conversations with some of the cast, things that luckily haven't been a part of a lot of their experience in life, which is a great thing, but it also means they didn't exactly understand how really serious that was and how people were treated. And that really has helped them not just understand that, but to then bring that knowledge to the characters that they're playing.
Agreed. And also with that, I think everyone in the cast has been very good at keeping a level of maturity with it. Everybody knows that it's a very sensitive subject and also that it's a very serious subject. But it's also a fun show. So it's good because the fun parts of the show can make it a little bit more lighthearted when there's the serious parts of the show.
Yeah. The N-word is in there. Of course, it was in Twain's novel a lot. And we thought it was interesting the author of this show sent pages and pages of notes about changes that he made. And that's one of the things that he did himself was to take out that reference several times and replace it with the word slave. And he left it in there, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times. Mm-hmm. And we looked at those places and decided on two or three of those places that we did think it was very powerful and really important to that scene, mm-hmm. and left those in. But we also thought it was really good because when that word is used, it really, especially at the beginning of rehearsal, it really kind of takes your breath almost, mm-hmm. which led to a really great discussion about how we've learned. You know, that word was just intended to be hateful and hurtful, and that's why it's not
okay.
something that we
don't do anything.
Would do.
Which is, yeah.
So, yeah, I think we've grown a lot. Not just within the show, but even just as people.
Did you know that that word was going to be used, Michael?
I figured, just because I know that that was a big deal in slavery and that word was used a lot around that time. So, and it's not a word that I haven't heard. Luckily, I haven't heard it like directed at me, but I've heard it in, you know, movies, Roots, different TV shows. So it's something I've heard before, and it didn't really shock me, but it was good to know that the word wasn't something that most people use. Like, I know there was people, like, that were in the cast that were a little uncomfortable with saying it at first. And that, to me, is nice to know. I think it says a lot about how far we've come and where we're heading at as people.
So this book has really detailed dialects. How did you work, Michael, to develop your specific character's dialect?
To work on Jim was very interesting. I actually started doing research as soon as I found out about it because I was so excited about doing Jim. So I looked at like YouTube videos of movies just to see how people have taken slave voice and how they've tried to emulate that. And so I took a lot from that and I tried to make it kind of a deep and kind of a dark, hurt character. At one point in the show, he says, slaves who tried to run off like me, but they got caught. Now they cross him back. Huck says, how do you know? And he says, he is it in the singing. And I think a lot of the voice, it needs to show how hurt he is and how hopeful he is at times, but still how much he's been through. And so that's what I've just tried to show.
Why do you think Huck was so accepting of Jim?
Well, I don't think he ever agreed with his family's views on anything. Not to say that he didn't agree with the slavery thing, because I don't think he really understands that until maybe halfway through the mm-hmm. show. But it's funny because Jim wants to escape, you know, to get his freedom. And I think Huck also wants to escape to get a different type of freedom. And so that dynamic comes into the play also about midway through, where I think Huck figures out that, you know, they're both in it together. And that's a very interesting part of the story. And I'm glad that, you know, Jim has a friend like Huck.
Rose Kristen Presson spoke with Michael Martin, who plays Jim in Playhouse in the Park's production of Big River, and the show's director, Lisa Cope. Big River runs through September 16th. You can find showtimes at WKMS.org.
I wish, by golly, I could spread my wings and fly and taste the sweetest taste of freedom for my soul. then I'd be free at last. Free at last. Great God Almighty, I'd be free at last. I'd be free at last.
For 30 years, between 1903 and 1955, baseball fans in our region looking to take in a live game didn't have to travel as far as they do today. In fact, the game came to them. The teams of the Kentucky, Illinois, Tennessee, or Kitty League, toured a circuit ranging from southern Illinois and western Kentucky to northwestern Tennessee and southern Indiana. For the most part, the players in this Class D minor league were fresh out of high school, just learning the ins and outs of professional baseball. Some made it to the majors, most didn't. But either way, their stories are being told in a new book, The Kitty League, Images of Baseball, by Kevin McCann and Josh Maxwell. Mr. Maxwell joins us now to talk about the book and the league that inspired it. Mr. Maxwell, thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'll begin by asking about the significance of the Kitty League in the larger world of pro ball.
Well, you have to understand it in context. The Kitty League was Class D minor league, and we know AAA, single A, and double A. But Class D people look at me when I tell them about the book, and they're like, what? This was 1903. So for Kentucky fans, this was pre-UK basketball. There wasn't NFL. There wasn't NBA. All we had as a really good professional sport was baseball. Mm-hmm. So this is what people would go out and they would do on an afternoon or an evening. Well, in the earlier years, you didn't have evening games because you didn't have lit games. And actually, the first night game in the state of Kentucky was in Hopkinsville.
Really?
What they did was they had the electric company come out, and they brought out two trusses and put big lights on them and to shine down onto the field. And they asked the crowd in the promotions in the newspapers to wear white to reflect the light. And I believe that might have been pre-Kitty League, but I don't think that's actually in the book.
That's ingenuity.
There you go. Yeah. But there's just so much history behind it. And myself and Kevin McCann split the book up into two sections. I had the earlier years. He had the latter years. A lot of the – well, not a lot, but some of the guys that played in the latter years, some of them are still around.
Hmm.
And what actually got me into doing the entire book was I was graduated from Murray State with a radio television degree, and I went on to pursue careers and do things in the video field. And I wanted to do a documentary on the Kitty League. And spoke with the historian, local historian, Mr. William Turner in Hopkinsville. And he said, well, I'd like to help you out, and we're going to help you out. He said, we want you to look into doing a book about this. There's lots of wonderful, wonderful stories in the book, and I'm very, very proud to have worked on it.
I'm curious to know about the social dimension of it, because it seems as though that if you're going to go out to the ball game, forgive the brushing up against the cliche there, but if you're going to go out to the ball game,
right,
you know, you're going to make an occasion of it. I mean, what kind of occasion was it that people would go to these ball games?
Well, they would take like their families and things like that out to the ball game, and people would come out, the men in the hats and the suits, and they'd come out and they'd take their jackets off and loosen up their collars after, you know, a day of work or on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday or whatever it was, and people would come out and they would dust their seats off and they would sell programs and hot dogs. And here in Western Kentucky, this is the league that was here for us. And a lot of people don't even know about it. So,
has that been an impediment to the research?
Not really. Like I call my grandparents, for instance,
right,
and they live in Russellville, which is out of the Kitty League zone.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, when you want to know about something that's in the 40s and before, you know, you ask your grandparents. It's just naturally what you do. And at our age, you know, you don't Google it, you know, even though I did do a lot of that. But they knew something about it, even though it was about 50 miles away from where they were established in Russellville. So they knew a little bit about it and could direct me to different people who may possibly still be alive. It was one thing led to another, and I actually spent a lot of time at the research library here at Murray State because there were things like Cairo, Illinois had a team in it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the early days, it was about 1906, 1907, Cairo and Paducah, there was no playoffs whatsoever, no playoffs. Whoever had the most wins at the end of the season won. It's just the way it was. Cairo and Paducah had kind of a, well, the whole league got together and said, we don't know who won, because in the Class D, there were people going up, there were people coming down, spending their careers there. They were going up into the majors, coming down, this, that, the other. So it was always changing. Teams were always changing. They said, well, we need to play a few more games to see who is the real winner.
Right.
So they extended the season. K-Roll was in the league when they extended the season. Then they were in second. Paducah was at the true winners because they added these games. K-Roll came along and said, well, wait a minute. Got into an argument, blah, blah, blah. The secretary took the record books and said, well, that's it. I'm out of here. Nobody's going to know the true winners of the Kitty League.
Really?
See y'all at it. Yeah, see you. They hadn't closed the meeting yet. So they closed it, reopened it in Paducah. They had a meeting in K-Roll, reopened it in Paducah, declared the Paducah Indians the winners. And in the record books, which was Spalding Guidebook, Spalding released a book about all of the leagues in America, mm-hmm. and the records and the top two and told a little story about them each year. The secretary of the league was a representative from K-Roll.
Mm-hmm.
He reported that K-Roll won that year. So unless you research it,
mm-hmm.
you never know that Paducah was the true winner. So my book corrects it. Yay. the significance of that whole story, another significance of that whole story, is that the man who invented the playoff system was on that losing K-Roll team, Frank
really?
Shaughnessy. The Shaughnessy playoff system, where first place third, second place fourth, and then those two winners play for the championship,
right,
came from Frank Shaughnessy. Now, I'm not here to say that we invented the, you know, the Kitty League had something to do with inventing the playoffs. But it kind of did. It, you know, and he later invented it and did some other things. Like he invented the huddle in football.
Really?
He went on to coach football and hockey and some different things.
That is remarkable. I mean, to uncover that kind of innovation happening right here,
yeah.
of all places. Well, you know, there's a certain specificity, or some would say hyper-specificity, that's just kind of part and parcel of local, or in this case, regional history. And that always makes me wonder how someone finds their way to that subject. And then it so engrosses them that they sit down and write a book about it.
Right. Well, I grew up in this region. This whole region has kind of been a part of my life. And driving home from work in downtown Hopkinsville, we have a mural. And one of the pieces on the mural is the Kitty League Hopkinsville Hopper baseball team. And I would see that mural all the time, and I love doing documentaries. And like I said, I started poking around and just doing a little bit of research on it. That's how I got into it.
Do you find that it's after that initial fascination that it's something engrossing about solving the mystery?
Yeah. Yes, I do. Shortest answer you'll get, yes.
Well, my last question is, appropriately enough, about the end of the league in 1955.
Right.
I noticed that it was right after the end of the Korean War, which mm-hmm. must have depleted the manpower to fill these teams. Mm-hmm. Why did the Kitty League end?
It is popular belief that television and air conditioning is kind of what killed Class D baseball. And who wants to watch Class D when there are so many other things pulling at my time, like basketball and football? And then it's really hot during baseball season.
You know, I've noticed that.
Especially this year. This is the first year in several that I haven't been to a pro game.
A little warm.
Yeah.
Along with Kevin McCann, Josh Maxwell is author of The Kitty League, published by Arcadia Publishing, and is now available in bookstores and online. Mr. Maxwell, thanks for coming by.
Thank you guys so much.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.